Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We have met the threshold. The Utah GOP says they have enough signatures to send a Prop 4 repeal initiative to Utah voters. Why is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints dumping billions in stocks? And how are Utah-based athletes faring at the Olympic Games in Italy? Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks.
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. Reporter Tony Semerat is with us. Tony, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Later in the program, we'll hear from outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. We'll start with Robert Gerke. I want to talk first about the Prop 4 repeal initiative. I guess the organizers say they have enough signatures.
Yeah, so Sunday was the deadline for the group that's pushing for the repeal of Proposition 4 to get their signatures in. They said they have delivered well over 200,000 signatures. The target, it was about 141,000. So if they have obviously over 200,000 signatures, it looks pretty good for them. There is a potential catch. The legislature also requires anybody putting an initiative on the ballot to get 8% of the registered voters in 26 of the state's 29 Senate districts. So they have to get all of those as well. Right now, they've got four of the Senate districts checked off the list out of with about 108,000 valid signatures so far. The clerks are still in the process of validating those signatures, and they have actually another 2 weeks or so to get those checked off. But you know, the Utahns for Representative Government are confident. Better Boundaries and other groups are out trying to get voters to withdraw their signatures, because you know, you have 45 days after your signature shows up on the lieutenant governor's website to withdraw if you regret having signed it or you feel like you didn't know what you were signing, that sort of thing. So there's still a lot of things in motion right now. I mean, my personal gut feeling looking at the numbers on a daily basis is that it's going to be pretty close on some of the Senate districts. There's a handful of them around the state where they're still only at about 40 to 45% of the signatures they need. And so even assuming that they do have, you know, 250,000 signatures, it could be fairly tight. And then that makes it, there's the potential that those groups that are opposing the repeal could get enough people to withdraw that it doesn't end up on the ballot. So we're going to have to wait and see, and we won't know this, won't know the answer probably until potentially early April.
As you say, if it's narrow in some of those districts, it could be vulnerable to people removing their signatures. That might tip it. That happened before, I think. Count My Vote, 2018?
Yeah. In 2018, Count My Vote was trying to get an initiative on the ballot that would have just gotten rid of the caucus convention system, basically, and gone to a direct primary system. They got enough signatures. They got them in 26 of the 29 districts, but they were so close in a couple, you know, just barely over the top, that opposition was able to go out and get enough people to withdraw signatures that they fell off the ballot. So, you know, it's not unprecedented. And Better Boundaries is working pretty hard. And there's other groups, a group called Brave Utahns Rapid Resistance Network. And they're you know, actively contacting, in some cases going door to door, knocking on people's doors, asking them to withdraw. Better Boundaries a couple weeks ago began sending out letters to everybody who signed, because the signature list is public. So they've been sending out letters to everybody who signed with a pre-filled form. All you have to do is sign it and stick it in the envelope that's already stamped and send it to your county clerk. So they're trying to get a lot of people to withdraw. The county clerk, Salt Lake County, had said that they'd had like about 1,300 of those withdrawals so far, from what we've been able to tell. About 1,500 statewide have already withdrawn their signatures. And so it's not an insignificant number when you're talking about the margins on some of these Senate districts potentially being fairly close.
As a comparison, you note in your story, Robert, that the union effort to repeal restrictions on unions, very limited amount of people asking to have their signature removed.
I think that was partly because the unions turned in over 300,000 signatures. So there wasn't a concerted withdrawal push with that one. They just kind of conceded defeat on it. So I think that I think the circumstances were a little bit different, but yeah, 1,300 in Salt Lake County, 1,500 statewide, and climbing. I mean, it's about 150 new ones a day from what we've been seeing over the last week. It's a significant number when we're talking again about the potentially a narrow margin in some of these Senate districts.
There was a push from prominent Republicans. President Trump weighed in, others.
President Trump, J.D. Vance, we had Mike Lee, Ted Nugent. They were pulling out all the stops down the stretch, which I think is significant. Those are names that have some clout in the state, in some circles. But it also, I think, kind of indicates that they maybe weren't as confident as they were presenting it to be. That they were really working right up until the last minute to make sure that the cushion, if they do get over the top, that the cushion is as big as it can be, and they have as much breathing room for the knockoff drive.
So, if this is ultimately successful, and you say we may not know until April, this would be on the ballot in November. What is there polling? Do we know how this might fare?
Yeah, so if they get there, then it goes on the ballot in November. Voters will decide. It won't affect the 2026 congressional districts. Maybe we should just briefly explain what it does. I mean, it repeals Proposition 4, which is the Better Boundaries Initiative. The initiative created an independent redistricting commission and set some redistricting criteria and prohibited partisan gerrymandering. So it would go on the ballot in November. And the polling is, Better Boundaries did a poll that said a two-thirds of people want it left in place. We can take that with a grain of salt because it's they obviously have a dog in the fight. The Sutherland Institute, a conservative think tank, said that 85% want an independent redistricting commission involved, and only 15% want the legislature to be able to do this on its own, sort of unilaterally. So there is potential, even if it does get on the ballot, it doesn't pass. But if it does get on the ballot, I think we'll see several million dollars, pouring into the state on both sides, and it'll be up to the voters.
Let's talk about a related matter. Here's the headline. Federal judges appear skeptical of ruling and lawsuit over Utah's new congressional maps. So a couple of our representatives took Judge Gibson's decision to court. Is that what they did?
Correct. Yeah, it was Representative Burgess Owens, Representative Celeste Malloy. There were a handful of county commissioners, county sheriffs, local officials who were also parties to this lawsuit. They went to federal court and asked a three-judge panel of federal judges to issue an injunction prohibiting the map that Judge Diana Gibson selected from being used in the 2026 elections. They argue that the U.S. Constitution gives the legislature sole authority to draw the redistricting maps, and they think that Judge Gibson overstepped by choosing one that had been submitted by the plaintiffs and wasn't drawn by the legislature. So there were arguments about a little over 3 hours of arguments on Wednesday before this panel. And it was, it's always risky to try to, figure out where the judges are leaning, but they seemed pretty skeptical of the arguments that the attorney for Representative Owens and Malloy were making. They made the point that, okay, if the judge hadn't done what she did, then what would we do? Would we just not have an election? There were deadlines that needed to be met. The legislature's maps were non-compliant. Assuming the legislature's maps were non-compliant, then what was to be done? There needed to be a map. So it seemed like they were a little bit skeptical, perhaps a little reluctant to get involved. But we should have a ruling on that motion sometime soon, probably by Monday. The lieutenant governor has said that they need to have a final map in place no later than February 23rd because the candidate deadline is the first week of March. Well, I think it's March 9th is when it opens. So they have to have a map in place by that time, and they have to do some preparation work to, make sure that the precincts are set up right and so forth. So there is this deadline looming. There's also a case at the Utah Supreme Court where the legislature is making a similar request to the Utah Supreme Court justices. They would like the Utah Supreme Court to reverse Judge Gibson's decision. We could have a ruling in that one as early as today, but most likely, if not today, then Monday would be the most likely outcome. So yeah, we're finally getting to some finality, I guess, in this ongoing thing. It feels like it's been going forever, but it's nearing the home stretch.
It's interesting. The plaintiffs here argued that Representative Owens, I guess Orr Malloy, focused on Owens, could be harmed, right? Could be redistricted out of a district.
Yeah.
But the lawyers on the other side argue that, well, Ben McAdams has already raised a bunch of money, and if it goes the other way, he could be harmed.
Yeah, I mean, Representative Malloy and Owens are the plaintiffs in this because they're the ones whose districts are kind of the most up in the air. There's Representative Kennedy's probably going to run in the district that encompasses Utah County. Representative Moore is probably going to run in the Northern Utah district. We don't know that for sure, but I think that's a fair assumption. But these representatives, Owens and Malloy, are kind of uncertain. Owens could run in the first district, which is the Salt Lake County district, or he could run in a primary against Representative Malloy. But that right now, Representative Malloy in particular has said, well, we don't know which district we should be campaigning in. Now, Representative McAdams filed a brief in the case opposing any changes to the map because he said he's already raised about $1 million. He's gathered 7,000 signatures to qualify for the ballot. He's hired staff. He's got offices. He's campaigning already. And so, he thinks that his attorney argues that if they were to pull the rug out from under him, he would be harmed by that. So that was one that kind of resonated, I think, with the judges as well. Representative Malloy has said that she's not spent any money because she doesn't know where she's going to be campaigning yet. And so, the harm might be less to her, is the argument, at least from the attorneys arguing that the map should stay in place.
We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Let's move to one last story, Robert. Governor Cox quickly signs Utah constitutional court into law, but legislature isn't done targeting the judiciary. So this idea of a constitutional court, I guess that's a reality now. What is this?
Yeah, it's changed a little bit from what it was originally, because it was originally proposed as a constitutional court. Its scope could actually be considerably broader now. But what it is that if the state is sued, either as the legislature, the governor, or the attorney general are sued in a civil action, they can ask the case to be sent to this three-judge panel of judges that would be randomly selected from each of the one each from different judicial districts. And the thinking is that most of these cases in the past, most of these civil actions against the state have been ended up in the third district. And the state, frankly, keeps losing, not all the time, but they've lost some high profile ones on abortion and redistricting and trans athletes and so forth. And so the thinking is that this three judge panel would bring a little bit of diversity to those cases in terms of at least geographic diversity. And so the legislature, the attorney general, or the governor can file a motion, and it would be moved to this from whatever judge is assigned to it to this three judge panel to hear the case. There's some criticism of it because the party that's challenging the state, challenging a state law, would not have the same latitude, so they wouldn't be able to choose the three-judge panel if they wanted to go that route. But the governor has it passed quite easily. The governor signed it. It takes effect immediately. The courts have until March 7th to come up with a mechanism for randomly signing the three judges, and then the legislature, or well, through the attorney general, can begin asking the three judge panel to take over cases that are already filed and pending. But as I mentioned, the scope of this could be pretty broad because it does apply to any civil action that is brought against the state or its entities.
There's another bill. This is interesting, HB 540, which would require courts to provide a live audio stream of public court proceedings. So, briefly, what's the pro and con on this?
Yeah, so this is something that House Speaker Mike Schultz is pushing pretty hard. He thinks that the judiciary is not transparent enough. He thinks it's the least transparent branch of government. And so he wants the courts to come up with a way to at least provide an audio stream of proceedings. He also wants judges to have to file financial disclosures, and he wants a cooling off period for when judges leave the bench. He doesn't want them to go work for firms that are going to or have sued the state in the past. And so, that's his argument that it would make it more transparent. There was some criticism of this because, from the state bar, Kim Cordova testified and said at the hearing and said, people who go to court are dealing with sensitive topics. They're either a criminal defendant or they're going through a divorce or, have a workplace dispute or things like that. And having that streamed, having those things live streamed to their friends and neighbors is an invasion of privacy and might deter people from going to court if you have issues with right as it stands right now. The bill would require juvenile court proceedings to be streamed, although the sponsor said he plans to remove that. So there's some sensitivity involved here, and there's also the cooling off period for judges is something that they are a little sensitive to as well, because for example, a judge could leave the bench and work for the state, but the judge couldn't leave the bench and work for a firm that has sued the state. And there's a lot of firms that have sued the state in the past, and so it would they think that would be unfair and frankly potentially unconstitutional to impose that cooling off period. So that bill has passed committee narrowly. The sponsor has said he's going to do some work on it, before it comes up for a vote. So it's waiting for a vote over in the House right now.
Just maybe 30 seconds more. HB 262 would require judges to get two-thirds of the vote in their retention elections. Right now, it's a simple majority. How is that faring?
That one I don't think has had a House hearing yet, so it may not go anywhere this session. Remember that we've already expanded the Supreme Court by two justices, from five justices to seven. We talked about that last week, I think. And so, there are a lot of bills that the legislature is proposing that are taking aim at the courts, and this is, coming on the heels, obviously, of a fairly serious set of setbacks. By the Republican for the Republican legislature at the hands of the court. So there's some they're in the crosshairs this session, you could say.
Well, I'm sure you'll be covering this. We've been talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Have a good weekend.
You too. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll have a brief break. We'll be back talking with reporter Tony Semerad. Here's the headline. We'll be talking about why is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints dumping billions in stocks? We'll have more following this.
Utah Public Radio presents the Corner Concert Series, where we invite Utah-based musicians to our station to play for us. Our next episode features a young band based out of Orem, Utah, called Ignatius. Recorded in the corner of our studio, Ignatius is a burst of electrifying energy with sounds similar to bands like the Backseat Lovers and Del Water Gap. The Corner Concert Series, Friday the 20th at 10 a.m. and Saturday the 21st at 3 p.m. Or watch the concert recording later on UPR's YouTube channel at upr.org.
It's time for UPR's annual Art Mug Contest, and we're asking you to submit your designs now through February 20th. You can use any artistic medium for your design. Just show us what you love about UPR, our programming, or our station's home here in Utah. You'll all get to vote on your favorite design, and the winner will be printed on this year's mug, available during our spring fun drive. For more details, go to upr.org/mugcontest and submit your designs to katie.swain@usu.edu by February 20th.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in next Salt Lake Tribune reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks.
Hey, you bet.
So here's the headline. Why is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints dumping billions in stocks? I guess a little background, Tony. It's a few years ago, a couple years ago, I guess, the church got in a little hot water for not disclosing, I guess, their portfolio as required. Now they are. So we do have the data, right?
Your listeners will recall the church's investment arm, Ensign Peak Advisors, has actually been reporting the contents of this immense investment fund that it runs for the church since 2020, since early 2020. And over the course of those quarterly reports to to federal regulators, there have been patterns of buying and selling, each quarter, reflecting the market. And what we noticed over the last two quarterly reports is a decided sort of selling pattern. The third quarter of last year, they sold about $2.1 billion of their holdings. And then this last quarter of last year, that figure leapt to 5.6 billion. And again, this is on an account that has held up to $60 billion in investments on behalf of the church. And so that last quarterly pattern accounted for about 9% a total of what was in the account. And it represented a pretty dramatic departure from the pattern that the account has showed since 2020. That is a sizable amount of money compared to the sort of coming and going that has gone on up until now. Just by way of the background you're referring to, prior to 2020, this was an account or a group of investments that the church went to great lengths to kind of keep secret. It had spread this these immense amounts of investments among up to 13 shell companies that it had created over the years, with the intention, at least according to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, with the intention of kind of keeping that out of public view. And then, again, your listeners will recall an IRS whistleblower that had worked for Ensign Peak Advisors went public with a lot of fascinating information about what was held in this account and what it was and was not used for. And then subsequent to that, in 2020, Ensign Peak began reporting. Since we've had those SEC reports, this has ranged from, maybe mid-30s in terms of billions of dollars up until a record high of 60 billion in the third quarter of 2025. And again, this is a real kind of mixed bag of diverse investments that the church says it maintains kind of as a rainy day fund, as a sort of a buffer towards economic downturns that could arise. This between the two quarters of last year, this represented about $7.7 billion of stocks sold.
I guess a broad range of stocks. I know the Inside Peak holds a lot of tech stocks, right? What are they selling off? What kinds of stocks are they selling off?
Well, so th this has got stocks, it's got bonds, it's got mutual funds, it's got stakes in private equity firms. It's, as I say, a very sort of diverse portfolio that, based on what we've been able to see over the last 6 years, seems to be just, sort of broadly diversified to kind of reflect the broad market. These sales seem to have come primarily from the portfolio's top 500 holdings, which focus on U.S. equities, sort of the big names in blue chip stocks that we would recognize as traded on the major exchanges. And what's interesting is that those stocks represent liquidity. That is, you're able to buy and sell those with perhaps a somewhat lower sort of fee load than you would if you were withdrawing a bunch of money from a mutual fund or a public equity stake. So these are, in terms of tech stocks, which, Ensign Peak has some of the biggest stakes in some of these tech companies, a $4.3 billion stock in or stake, I'm sorry, in computer hardware maker NVIDIA, $3 billion stocks in Microsoft and Apple. It's been a tech-heavy portfolio reflecting the market for those 6 years that we've seen it. But yeah, those seem to be those sort of better known over the counter, kind of U.S. equities seem to be primarily where these sales have come from.
So much bigger sell-off than usual. The question is why? What does the church say?
Well, that's where it gets really fascinating. The church is not saying why. In our inquiry, it issued a kind of a standing statement that it's issued before with regard to what Ensign Peak is for, kind of referring to that sort of rainy day ethic, representing that Ensign Peak plays a sort of a role in the church's own financial stewardship and investing reserve funds and kind of managing these, it consistent with kind of church policy. But there is, some interesting kind of speculation as to what has motivated these sales. Again, up until now, since 2020, when we've had a look at this thing each quarter, the portfolio tends to mimic or tends to mirror, if you will, the S&P 500, which is a standard market index that tracks a broad range of stocks. Ensign Peak has really kind of shaped its strategy to, there'd be little positions where it holds more or less than the S&P 500, but it's really tried to mirror that stock index. And so this set of sales over the last 6 months really represent a departure from that strategy as well. And so the speculation is that could this represent some sort of a sharp pivot away from U.S. equities? And the speculation again, but does this sort of represent a kind of a negative longer term outlook of stocks? Again, the church isn't, nor Ensign Peak are really commenting on whether that's the case. There's another interesting sort of potential motivation that these stocks or these holdings rather, because of their size, they exceed $100 million threshold that the SEC sets for requiring those holdings to be reported. If you hold 100 million or more, you've got to report it. And th so the th moving this money out of Ensign Peak may represent an attempt to kind of move it out of public view. If you're parking that money instead with third-party managers, as an institutional investor, you're not required to report it. That institutional manager might be required to report it. But there is it a move, the speculation goes, towards sort of more opacity, that they're trying to kind of move some of this money out of public view and subsequently would not be required to file what are called 13F filings with the SEC to kind of make that public. It could also be, just a standard move to toward what you think you're going to get more money out of, a better yield, or maybe lowering your management costs with regard to kind of not, put it in an index fund, which kind of automatically tracks the market, and there would be lower management fees with regard to that money. But probably the more intriguing possible explanation is that the church needs large amounts of cash for some sort of a purchase, a new initiative, or some kind of other urgent use, and that's where the speculation notches up significantly because, anybody familiar with where the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is at right now can probably think of several reasons why they might need money. They've been on a worldwide temple building campaign for a number of years and have announced a wide range of additional temples, That policy has sort of shifted with the change in the presidency. Of course, former President Russell Nelson passed away last year. New President Dahlin Oaks has been elevated, and he has said, Oaks has said from the pulpit that he's shifting gears on the temple building campaign. And could this be perhaps raising money to kind of complete those quickly? And that $7.7 billion figure would pretty closely match estimates, at least from people that study this issue, would pretty much match what it would cost to kind of get those, expedite the completion of those temples. And again, this is just me kind of speculating at this point. There are a lot of others that are speculating online as to what this money could go for. But the church is shaping up some really kind of major logistics for its 6-month open house planned in 2027 for the reopening of the iconic Salt Lake Temple in downtown Salt Lake City. It's a huge plan that the church is putting together for the estimated 3.3 or to 5 million visitors that will come through Salt Lake City to see the temple, which will be open for the first time in more than a century, after years of renovation to the temple. Again, the church has also been, in very interesting ways over the last 2 or 3 years, has been kind of ratcheting up its global charitable and humanitarian efforts. It's been expanding those with a significant sort of dollar figure attached to that. Could this money be for additional global charitable and humanitarian efforts? And in the end, it's probably going to be a combination of all these things or something else entirely. Again, going to kind of the speculative nature of all of that. But yeah, it's been a very I'm not I don't love the word dumping because this is selling, it's been a pretty dramatic accumulation of cash.
We've been talking with reporter Tony Samurai telling us about this interesting story. And I'll just, if we had time, we're going to talk a little bit about this one. We're out of time, so I'll just point readers to sltrib.com to read about USA Climbing. They have released plans for their national training center in Salt Lake City. Looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, it does.
Tony Samurai, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you, Tom.
And you are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Program continues following a break. Here is the headline. How are Utah-based athletes faring at the Olympic Games in Italy? We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune outdoors reporter Julie Jack. Hope you stay with us through the break.
A suite of seismometers on the moon may be the first to record a possible impact of an asteroid hitting the lunar surface.
Something hitting the moon like this is unprecedented, as far as we know, in history, in terms of being recorded.
NASA's return to the moon and other celestial activity creating a stir on the next Big Picture Science.
Tune in Sunday morning at 11 here on UPR.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and Import Auto in Logan, a TechNet service center with Brian Morgan and the team, with service options for Land Rover, Volkswagen, Subaru, and more, including tune-ups, CV joints, and water pumps. Learn more at import-auto.biz.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And in this part of the program, we check in with outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been following the Olympics. You that's in your beat. And of course, the Winter Olympics are going on right now in Italy. We wanted to focus in on Utah-based athletes there in Milan Cortina. And there are quite a few of these, especially winter sports athletes, I guess, set up their homes, have Utah connections.
That's right. It seems to be a very popular place. I was just talking to some athletes, not Olympic athletes, but other skiers that are doing really well out in the world. And they said that they thought it was due to just Utah's proximity to the mountains. People move out here from all over the place and they just stay and they ski. They move here for the skiing and they stay for the skiing. So I think that's part of why. And then that culture just feeds upon each other, right? You've got good people to ski with or ride with, and then you just keep doing well.
So skiing, sliding, skating, all sorts of winter sports at the Olympics. Is there a concentration where Utah athletes specialize?
You know, we're across the board. I noticed that we don't have very many snowboarders, but most of the speed skating team, both speed skating teams are here, both short track and long track. We've got a lot of skiers. Most of the, I guess they call it speed side of skiing, most of the women come from here, and then Ryan Cochran Siegel is here as well. You know, everybody knows Lindsey Vonn. She lives in Park City. So we kind of, it's across the board. We don't have a lot of the cross-country skiers here. We have a few, but they all train up here at Soldier Hollow. So kind of all the sports touch on us.
You mentioned Lindsey Vonn. I think we probably heard her Olympics weren't great.
Yeah, you know, that was pretty, I don't know. No one, I think, saw this coming. I mean, she made this amazing comeback. She was trying to ski as, you know, she had a crash a week before the Olympics, and she tore her ACL, and so she, which is, you know, a ligament in your knee. So she was, but she decided that she didn't really have anything to lose. She's 41, and she was just like, I can ski on it. You know, we did some testing, and she skied on similar before, I think. And so she decided to go for it. And I think she was feeling really strong going into the downhill. You know, obviously a little, probably a few doubts with that knee. But then she came out of the gates on the downhill, and pretty early on, she caught one of them with an arm, and it just whipped her to the side. So it didn't have anything to do with her knee. She crashed because she caught that gate, and she ended up shattering her leg. And then I saw she had a social media post today that said that she actually did a lot more damage than that. So I don't think we'll probably see her back at the Olympics, but you know, you can't count her out.
In the lead up, it was an amazing comeback, right? She won some World Cup events.
She was doing amazingly. Like at the end of her, at the end of the World Cup season running into the Olympics, she'd won several events, and I think was just in December became the oldest woman to win a downhill World Cup race.
You had an article on bobsledders. There are some Utah-based folks there. How's the bobsledders doing?
Yeah, so I wrote on Keisha Love, and she is a Harriman native, and she started out 4 years ago. She made it to Beijing basically straight, like she'd been a track athlete, got recruited to, as many bobsled athletes do, you'll find out, got recruited to be a bobsled athlete, and those are the brakemen, as they call them, or the pushers. That in a two-person bobsled as the person that is behind, not the driver. So she got recruited to that and had a really good showing in with Kaylee Humphreys in Beijing. But Humphreys ended up hurting her leg right before the final heat or the final runs, and they ended up taking seventh. And she said that she was kind of disappointed by that. Like she thought they'd gotten off to a good start, and kind of hinted that it might have been something to do with the driving, or at least that she felt like she didn't have any control over the course of their future. So she, after that event, decided that she wanted to become a driver, which usually takes, you know, 6 years or something to do. And she turned it around in 3 and So she did the monobob already, and she placed seventh. And so she has still the two women will be this, well, was this morning. Something I didn't get to write about, but is really interesting, is that the two main coaches for bobsled, and you'll see one of them at the start, it's a man in a short haircut. Anyway, he, Chris Foate, he is, lives in, down in Orem, and then the women's coach, head women's coach, also lives down there, and they live just a few miles apart.
So tell me about other sports. I'm sure there are other Olympic sports here covered by Utahns here.
Oh my goodness, so many. So Ryan Cochran Siegel, as I said, he's a skier. He took silver in the Super G, so that's his second silver medal. Oh, and then I have to talk about the moguls. This has been one of my favorite events since I saw it at Deer Valley. Deer Valley has had World Cup moguls for years, and when they host them, they host the regular moguls, the single moguls, and then the dual moguls. And Utah always has, most of the athletes in moguls come from Utah, or they live in Utah, either way. So they did really well in the women's, in the individual, the American woman took gold, but a woman who now lives in Utah, Jalen Koff, took silver. And then they did the dual moguls, and Koff took silver, and Lemley took bronze. And the dual moguls has never happened before in the Olympics. This was the first time. And what happened is that Hannah Kearney, who's one of only two women who have won gold medals in the Olympics, was like, hey, we've been having dual moguls in the World Cup since like the late 80s, early 90s. Like, why are these not in the Olympics? And she, about 3 or 4 years ago, got a bunch of other nations on board to say that they would like to have it in as well. And so they added it in this year, and it was so exciting. And I think one of the most viral clips of the Olympics is the skier, a dual moguls clip in which Nick Page, who's from Park City, is skiing next to an athlete from Japan. And the athlete from Japan goes off a jump, and he ends up kind of crashing out, but he ends up going backward across the ski line. And he ended up winning that run and going on to take a silver.
So I was reading your article about dual moguls. It's kind of more go for broke, I guess. You're skiing against another skier, you know, right next to you.
Right, exactly. And that's what, it really changes things. I mean, moguls is kind of wild to me anyway, probably because I'm not very good at moguls when I ski. So to see them do it so quickly, and then to see them also go off a couple of jumps and do flips and then land and do more moguls is kind of mind-blowing to me anyway. But then to add this, like, having somebody else going straight down next to you, and the athletes told me like they can hear the person breathing and they can hear the crowd react to what the person's doing. And you'll see more crashes there, people crashing off the course or going off the course, than you will probably in any other ski course.
Mm. Any Utahns in figure skating or curling or some of those?
We don't have any in either of those two. No, mm-hmm. I think they're kind of grassroots groups working on that, especially in the figure skating, I know. But yeah, this year, no. But I did write an article about Nathan Chen, who won the gold 4 years ago, and how he has influenced the sport as far as like the flips and the artistry and the quads, of course.
Yeah, he was known as the quad king, right?
Right, yeah, he's the quad king, and Ilya Malinin said he's the quad god now,
right,
which he's self-deemed, but yeah, so he said that Nathan Chen has really inspired him, and I kind of would like to keep on that story. I'm curious if Nathan had any words, kind words or words of encouragement for Ilya after Ilya's kind of heartbreaking performance in the long program. That's something that Nathan's gone through as well.
Yeah, it's disappointing. I'm sure he'll have to come back from that. You did ask Nathan Chen in I guess that article if he thinks there will ever be a quintuple right. spin.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think when he got started, like, that was, like, who would ever think of that? But I think he thinks that it's a possibility that maybe the human body can do that. But it really just kind of comes down to, will they need to, you know, like, if nobody is pushing Ilya, well, obviously there are people pushing Ilya, but, you know, if he doesn't have to do it in order to win, then he probably won't, right? Like, that, there's not like that need to push it that far. Plus it's really hard on the body. But if the competition keeps going up and up as it seems to do, then, probably eventually we will have a quint.
You point out in that article that last judging scandal, which I think was Salt Lake, wasn't it?
Right.
After that, they went to emphasize more the technical aspects, made it more mathematical, but it might swing back more artistic in the future.
Yeah. So is the judging scandal, you know, before was just basically based on kind of impressions, right? Like, this is what the judges thought of it, and there was no real backing to it. So now you see all those scores on your screen that, you know, turns green when they're ahead of the curve as far as like difficulty goes, and then red when they fall behind. So I think this is encouraging more technical, right? Like, more of the jumps, more of that that switch when there was that scandal in Salt Lake City where the French judge voted for the Russians over the Canadians.
So any other Utahns you want to mention who are in Milan, Cortina?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have to mention Breezy Johnson. I mean, she's a Utahn, and she has been battling for a long time to have Olympic success. And then she really just broke it out of the gate with the first medal of the games was the downhill women's, and she won it. And that, I think, was just amazing. She, you know, a real accomplishment, and really shows, like, she's fought through a lot of, I think, mental issues as well as physical issues, and to come out and do that was amazing. And then, you know, after the women's combined, then she got a proposal, a marriage proposal. So
oh, really?
She's having a pretty good Olympics. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a pretty good one. Yeah. I mean, it's been a really rough Olympics for, like, Kristen Santos Griswold. She's a short track speed skater. She had a really rough Beijing Olympics as well. And this year she's had 2 fourth place finishes, so that's a tough pill to swallow, right? When you're that close, but not. And then the other one that I feel like I really need to mention is Mac Forehand, who's a freestyle skier. If you didn't get to see the men's big air competition, just crank it up and get some popcorn, because it is fascinating. The announcers were saying that they thought it was probably the best big air competition they'd have ever seen, and I have to agree. I mean, the scores were wild, and people like Mac were throwing down these tricks that they have never even tried before, right? So to do that and then to land them and make it look easy was just kind of mind-blowing. So it's a really exciting competition. Spoiler alert, he ended up getting the silver in that one, but somebody asked him if he felt like he was robbed, and he's like, no, I can't do the things that the guy that won, who's from Norway, is doing.
I want to just one more thing, Julie. You wrote an article on ski mountaineering, SkiMo, I guess it's called. It's making its Olympic debut in Milan, Cortina, and I guess it'll probably appear in the Salt Lake Olympics when it comes here.
Well, they don't know yet. The odds are, you know, if I was a betting person, I would say the odds are pretty strong that it will be, mostly because as people in the SkiMo, as they call it, world are saying, like, you know, Utah is the place to do SkiMo. Like, this is where SkiMo came from in the U.S., the birthplace of it in the U.S., I guess you'd say.
I probably should have asked you, I'm not familiar with SkiMo. What does it look like?
Yeah, so it's kind of wild. It is... If you imagine somebody cross-country skiing uphill only, well, I guess not only, but cross-country skiing uphill, and then they take off at certain points, they're required to take off their skis, and then they have to put them in a backpack in a certain way, and then they run up, then they run in their ski boots, which aren't, you know, they're cross country ski boots, basically. They're not like our hard ones, but then they run up either like stair steps that are cut into the snow, or I saw the ones in Italy are actual just stairs. Like they just have them run up the stairs, and then they get up to the stairs, and then they probably have to put the skis back on and then ski up a little further, and then they rip off these climbing skins, these that are on the bottom of their skis that help them go upward, and then they stuff them into a pouch and ski down like a downhill course as fast as they can. So it is very fast paced. The sprint version is one lap, and so it's just, you know, an all out, like your heart rate up as high as probably possible. But there is a longer version that is not yet in the Olympics that goes a little more backcountry, but does quite a bit of climbing and descending as well.
Mm-hmm. What's the one, and I don't know if it'll ever be in the Olympics, so where horses are involved?
Ski-joring.
Ski-joring, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that ever going to make it to the Olympics?
You know, I think it has a good chance of being a demonstration sport for Utah, which means that, you know, no real medals will be handed out for it. But I think there are a lot of things that go against it being an accepted sport. I think there are a lot of other sports ahead of it, for one thing. And also, as the Summer Olympics have found, getting horses into competition venues into different countries has been very tricky. So
yeah,
that
would be a problem. Yeah. One more thing, just out of curiosity, I'm fascinated by this sport, the biathlon. If I have the right name for it, you ski, right? It's speed involved. Then you have to get your heart rate down and be accurate with a gun.
Yeah, I love that sport. It does not get a lot of attention on TV, which I think is too bad, probably partly because the U.S. has not been great at it in the past. But you can catch a couple of competitions up at Soldier Hollow every once in a while. But yeah, it's just same, you know, like you're not just cross-country skiing all out, but then yeah, you have to lay down on the snow and bring down your heart rate or shoot between heart rates it's very small target, you know, pretty far away. And then, you know, attach your pistol and then get up and go again. So yeah, it's pretty fun to watch, and it's pretty amazing what they can do.
Well, we've been talking with Julie Jagg, outdoors reporter, been telling us about the Olympics going on right now and Utah-based athletes involved. Julie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I always like to talk the Olympics.
Yeah, wonderful. And of course, we're looking forward to coming to Utah. The countdown is going. It'll be here before we know it.
Before we know it, right?
Yeah. Thank you, Julie. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with us again next week.